The dark commerce that's driving endangered species to extinction, like rhinos.
There are fake hunters, trafficked Asian women who pose as hunters that have been involved in facilitating the trade that goes on by Asian crime syndicates that are operating in South Africa and are moving these rhino horn to crime organizations in Asia under the protection of high-level officials in Laos, Vietnam, and other Southeast Asian countries. And there is corruption all the way along the supply chain.
That's Louise Shelley. We talk with her about her book, Dark Commerce, How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future. It's a shocking exposé of the links between government corruption, terrorism, and international crime syndicates that's destroying wildlife, forests, and oceans. Then we talk with Wendell Potter, health insurance executive turned whistleblower and author, about how health industry lobbyists are influencing the debate over Medicare for All. All that and more coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Welcome to the show. And hey, do you know that you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. The illicit trade in endangered animals and natural resources long predates the current day, but recent technology has changed the fundamentals of this kind of trade. In the past three decades, the use of computers and now social media have ramped up the illicit trade to unprecedented heights. As my guest Louise Shelley shows in her book Dark Commerce, this tech-enabled illegal trade is threatening our very future by undermining the foundations of the natural world that sustains us. Among other impacts, it's driving migration as the forests, fish, and other natural systems that sustain human communities are destroyed. Dark commerce connects terrorism, the capture of international trade by criminal networks, and rampant government corruption to mass extinctions, climate change, and ecosystems loss. Louise Shelley is professor of public policy at George Mason University and founder and director of its Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center. In addition to Dark Commerce, she's the author of Human Trafficking and Dirty Entanglements, among other books. Shelley was an expert witness in the Prevezon case that charged Natalia Veselnitskaya with money laundering. Veselnitskaya was the Russian lawyer who met with Trump campaign officials in Trump Tower in 2016 and is a pivotal figure in the investigation into Russian interference in the presidential election. I spoke with Louise Shelley soon after the Prevezon case was made public, as you'll hear later in the interview. But first, I started out by asking her about the Terrorism, Transnational Crime and Corruption Center and how it got involved in investigating the resource trade.
The Terrorism, Transnational Crime and Corruption Center that I direct at George Mason University is the only center of its kind in the United States. If you can believe, there are terrorism centers, but not those that connect it to the corruption and the transnational crime that make it thrive. And there are no other centers focusing extensively on corruption either. So I teach a lot on this issue, and my courses have resulted in my writing books. So the first one I wrote was on human trafficking, which is one element of dark commerce. Then I went on to Dirty Entanglements, which has a subheading of corruption, crime, and terrorism. And that looked a lot at how the illicit actors in the world were being funded by illicit trade in commodities, and particularly in natural resources. So when I was finished with that book, I felt that part of the problem needed much more attention. And fortunately, I received an initial grant from the Carnegie Corporation to write and spend 2 years working on sort of burning global issues that need more attention. And So for this book, I had to read a lot on what is going on in computers and cyberspace and environmental issues and environmental conservation, because those are the two areas in which I've seen the greatest growth in illicit trade.
And such a pity, too, because given how many threats the natural world is under in any case, this just adds to the problem.
It adds to it and magnifies it, because it is with enormous rapidity that we see the growth of this illicit trade. For example, in 2007, in South Africa, there were 7 rhino killed by poachers. And within less than a decade, within about 7 or 8 years, there were over 1,000 being killed annually. And despite the government investing large amounts of money to try and protect the animals, the problem didn't go away. It didn't keep growing at the rate it was growing, which was exponentially before, but it hasn't disappeared. And at this rate, the rhino are headed for extinction. So that's just one example that shows the exponential growth of this trade, a trade that is facilitated by social media, that facilitates communications, deliveries, contacts between buyers and sellers in very distinct parts of the world. And so what I see is an illicit trade, basically, that I say is on steroids. And as we are living in what I call a resource-scarce planet, as we have 7.5 billion people on the planet, there are less and less resources for each one of them, and therefore the commodities or natural resources turn into valuable commodities that are increasingly subject to illicit trade.
Well, that's really tragic. And you mentioned the cyber, the use of the internet, cyber technology. How exactly does it work that it has made this trade so much larger?
In the past, and part of the book is a historical analysis that goes back 4,000 years. And believe it or not, illicit trade was very consistent ever since we've had written history, since Hammurabi's Code. And people dealt in tangible objects. Say they stole property, they went to the local fence who they knew. He paid him in coins or some other valuable. And that's how this illicit trade functioned. But now, in this enormous cyber world, we have this phenomenon scaling at just rapid rates. Just as Amazon is leading to the decline of people going into stores and to malls and shopping areas, people are turning online to buy their commodities. So they're buying counterfeits, and they're buying ivory, and they're buying timber products that are made from illicitly obtained items. And this is just occurring on a massive scale. And so we are having the depletion of resources in a way that we've never really known in such a short period of time.
Yeah, you say, in fact, that this trade is one of the top 5 most lucrative transnational organized crimes worldwide. You rank it alongside narcotics, human trafficking, illicit weapons. Tell us more about the connections between governments, organized crime networks, and corruption.
I'll give you some illustrations that will show you how it works. Because if you think about it in the abstract, it's not so real. It's not so understandable. But let's take the rhino horn, which is a large and valuable trade that is valued at maybe $250 million a year. A small subset of what the illicit trade is in fish or in timber, but still valuable. And so it combines with other kinds of illicit trade. For example, there are fake hunters, trafficked Asian women who pose as hunters that have been involved in facilitating the trade that goes on by Asian crime syndicates that are operating in South Africa and are moving these rhino horn to crime organizations in Asia under the protection of high-level officials in Laos and Vietnam and other Southeast Asian countries. And there is corruption all the way along the supply chain. And I was working with a team to try and help address this issue and do some of the investigation of supply chains and flows. But at that time, there was a very corrupt minister of security who was working hand in hand with the Chinese cartels, as was shown in a very good documentary, and he impeded many of the efforts to stop this trade. So this trade is not that of just one single group. It thrives and depends on corruption and works globally.
You have done a lot of work also on the relationship between terrorism, organized crime, and corruption in Russia, the former Soviet Union. Talk about their role in this and how, you know, I mean, I think what's so fascinating is that corruption is really at the center of this. So it is this kind of connection between governments and crime. So talk about the former Soviet Union and how it is involved in this illicit resource trade.
I'm so glad you asked, because I've talked about this book and not enough people have asked me either about corruption or about the former Soviet Union. And these are key parts of the story. So how I got interested in these issues is that I've been working on post-Soviet crime, because I worked on crime in the Soviet Union and then post-Soviet crime, where I saw the rise of organized crime. And elsewhere in the world, we've seen organized crime really being growing with the drug trade. But in Russia, the illicit trade was in natural resources, because that was what the economy had to sell. So I was working in the Russian Far East, and there was major timber sales to China, to Japanese organized crime, massive amounts of fish that were being traded to the Yakuza in Japan. And that sort of awakened me to the scale of this problem, and some of the people who were investigating and fighting it were being murdered by the crime groups, and this trade was going on in the deforestation under officials. So that's sort of how I first saw this problem. But there's another very serious problem in Russia today, which is the problem of something called corporate raiding, in which officials who are politically connected and businessmen who are politically connected deprive others of their businesses using illegal means, using corruption, using fraudulent documents. And these businesses can be enormously large. In one case in which I was an expert witness, it was a $250 million business. There was a case in New York in which I worked as an expert witness, which is called the Prevazon case, which is very well known today because Natalia Veselitskaya, who was working for the defendant, the Russian defendant, had been involved in a corporate raid, and she was indicted 2 days ago. So this corporate raiding makes it extremely difficult to run a legitimate business, because if you build a business, it can be taken away from you, and literally, according to official Russian government statistics, hundreds of thousands of businessmen are locked up every year in prison to make it easier to steal their businesses.
Isn't this what happened to Bill Browder, the guy whose lawyer, Magnitsky, got brutally killed in jail in Russia?
That was the Hermitage business, and that's where the profits wound up in New York in this Prevazon case. But so this is just a massive phenomenon, and because of that, people don't start businesses. There are just huge risks to doing it, or they're hard to maintain these businesses. So Russia has an enormous amount of tech talent. It's got tech talent and it's got natural resources. And so we have large numbers of people going to the dark side, running illicit websites, hacking businesses, because they cannot make a legitimate living. And so they're involved in large-scale computer crime, and they're involved in large natural resource theft.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Louise Shelley about her book about the illicit trade in wildlife and natural resources, Dark Commerce, How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future. So basically what you're saying is that the kleptocracy, which is the Russian government at this point, connected in with organized crime, and I'm just going to come out and say that, and that we've been hearing so much about in connection with, President Trump and the Mueller investigation, is actually because of this structure of kleptocracy, it is driving the Russian, anyone in the Russian economy or more people in the Russian economy to the dark side in this trade of natural resources, as well as other things, that is so undermining our world. And now I want to ask you is, what is the impact of this trade in natural resources? I mean, we talked about the rhinos. Talk about the wider impact on the natural world, and then I'm going to ask you about other impacts.
For example, we now have enormous threat to fish. And this is not just, a hypothetical threat. This is real. We are taking fish out of the sea in ways that are undermining this major protein source for 2 billion people in the world, and it is also undermining the livelihoods of many people. So we have many Asian fishing trawlers, legitimate companies, but often using trafficked laborers, working off the coast of West Africa, so taking in so much fish that people cannot be eating, they cannot be maintaining their livelihoods, and many of them are taking off with their feet and becoming the illegal migrants to Europe.
Wow.
And it is not just a problem of over there. Officially, 20% to a third of all the allegedly wild-caught fish in the United States is IUU fishing. That means it's illegally obtained.
Illegally?
Illegally. It's in our pet foods. It's on our tables. It is a large part of the fish that we're consuming. And the shrimp that we're consuming is often collected in Southeast Asia by trafficked workers. And this is an extremely problematic area. So in the future, how are people going to support themselves and feed themselves with protein when they're losing so much of this most needed resource? And the trade in this illicit fish is in the billions of dollars annually. On trees, we're also talking of business over, estimated at $150 billion a year. And much of this is going on in rainforests. And when you cut down a rainforest, it is not easily replaceable. So some of these areas that are the most important ecological places on the planet to maintain diversity of species, to ensure that we absorbing carbon from the air, are being cut down.
And to provide the very oxygen that we breathe, is that not so?
Absolutely. And there was a wonderful exhibition that I went to about a year and a half ago at the Victoria and Albert that I write about in Dark Commerce, in which there's a whole section on plywood. It's an exhibition on plywood. And you might say, that's very boring. But then there were panel after panel on the illicit trade in plywood and how these precious rainforest woods are then disguised as plywood that we're having and using and flooring in our houses. So we're all part of the problem. And not knowing the supply chain and the sources of it, it is extremely disturbing. I can give you another example. There's one oligarch, or kleptocrat, I would say, in Borneo, who deforested with funding from Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs that helped him build, buy the equipment and build the roads. He deforested 80% of one of the last remaining pristine rainforests and made $10 billion from this, approximately, which he had to share with other corrupt officials, but he managed to hold on to a lot of it himself. And following the money trail for this, the money wound up in the Lincoln Building in Seattle. And what is significant is that the Lincoln Building in Seattle, which is a large office building, houses the headquarters of the FBI, the regional headquarters of the FBI that is supposed to investigate corruption. And GAO, which is our Government Accountability Office, said, we need to be more careful in the facilities that we're renting because this is a national security challenge to us.
National security challenge. Tell us more about that.
Well, if you're renting a building from a corrupt official overseas, and this is a problem of money laundering into real estate, of which I write in the book, you are having people engaging in, as in this example, in crimes against natural resources, and then they are having, you know, leverage in some ways over the FBI that's their tenant. So this is not a removed problem. It is a problem that may be happening thousands of miles away from us, but the consequences for the air of deforestation, for carbon in the air, for global warming, affect all of us, and yet the money and following the money trails, one sees how this dirty money that's so easily entering our economy also affects us and our prime agencies that are supposed to protect our security as well.
So this is such a dire issue. I mean, it connects security, terrorism, climate change, the sixth mass extinction that we're going into at this time, that we are already in, as a matter of fact. What is being done, or is there anything that's being done to combat it? That's first. And then I'm going to follow up by asking you what the listener can do.
There are things being done. When I set out to write the chapter on what is being done, I just started writing and it went on and got longer and longer. And then I had to, you know, stop it at 45 pages in raw text. And there's more I could say. So there are things being done by governments. There are things being done by companies. There are things being done by citizens. And there are things being done at the community level. For example, of buying cooperatives in India that are trying not to buy deadly pesticides and buying them for the less educated members of the community. There are lobster men in Maine who are going after their fellow lobstermen who are engaging in overfishing. So there are community controls and community activities that people are doing to try and save their local lives. But I think there's much more that needs to be done in making the new technologies, the platforms that are selling illicit commodities, more responsible. A little while ago, in this summer, the Senate regulated for the first time the commercial online platforms and made them responsible for not perpetuating the sale of trafficked human beings. Up till then, there weren't really sanctions for them for running massive ads for sex trafficking. And I think there needs to be much more regulation of online platforms, which is something that the U.S. has not been doing. There's been more going on in the EU, but we have favored unfettered growth of online platforms and social media. And as we've seen, they've been abused for false news. They've been abused for, you know, hate speech. And they've been also abused for dark commerce. And we need to be integrating this discussion of dark commerce into some of the other threats that we have of the economy. And citizens need to be demanding more action from our legislators, just as they got results on human trafficking, which happened through bipartisan cooperation. So this is something in which there can be much more citizen action and demand on understanding supply chains and being much more intelligent consumers. And the technology companies need to be pressured to do more with their technology and be engaged in technology for good, and to try and make their technology available and their data to do the kind of analysis that one needs to weed out these bad actors that are operating on their platforms.
Are there some websites or some legislation on the web that people, that listeners can go to find out what they can do to make this situation better?
There's some legislation now. I could send you a link on what is being done on conservation. There is some tech for good. I'll send them to you right after this.
That's
and
perfect.
People can be aware of what needs to be done and is being done, but there needs to be much more attention to this issue. Government is beginning to do more of it, but this shutdown certainly isn't helping us at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Louise Shelley, I am so glad that you have brought this extremely dangerous illicit trade in resources to light. In your book, Dark Commerce, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and we will be providing links so people can find out what they can do more to help help solve this terrible problem. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Louise Shelley is professor of public policy at George Mason University and founder and director of its Terrorism, Transnational Crime, and Corruption Center. In addition to Dark Commerce, she's the author of Human Trafficking and Dirty Entanglements. Go to writersvoice.net to read the introduction to Dark Commerce. You'll also find links to learn more about what's being done to combat the illicit economy. Next up, how are the health insurance industry and big pharma influencing the debate on Medicare for All? Find out after the break.
Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, in the beginning. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, long time ago.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations, transcripts, and extended interviews. This week, President Trump said he would end Obamacare and thereby the health care of at least 21 million people. Then he backtracked and said he would pass a health care plan that was better than Obamacare after the election. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, the debate over Medicare for All is heating up. Many 2020 candidates say they support it, although some are vague on what that means. Strong supporters like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders pledged to protect Obamacare from Trump's assault, while at the same time pushing to replace it over time with Medicare for All. They argue only bold change can mend our broken healthcare system. But other Democrats are coming out against Medicare for All. Health insurance industry whistleblower Wendell Potter wrote a post last week entitled "Democrats on the Take," about how Democratic attacks on Medicare for All are being fueled by health insurance cash. By the way, plenty of cash goes to Republicans, too. Wendell Potter has been on Writer's Voice before to talk about his books, Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take, as well as about Tarbell.org, the website he founded that investigates the health insurance industry. I called up Wendell Potter to find out more. You wrote a post about an article published by The Hill, a story that they published earlier in March. DCCC chief says, Medicare for All price tag, quote, a little scary. So this new chief of the DCCC is Representative Sherry Bustos of Illinois. Tell us about her in the context of this post.
Well, I was not necessarily surprised to see that headline because earlier, mid-year last year, just before the New York primary, which Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was taking on Joe Crowley in a district in New York, I was looking to see how much money Crowley had taken from healthcare special interests, and I was looking to see in particular which members of Congress had taken the most from the five largest health insurance companies and their political action committees. And lo and behold, Crowley was right up there in the top five, but heading the list was Sherry Bustos. So I was not a bit surprised to see that story. She has a history also of working for a big hospital system, big integrated healthcare system in the Midwest. So I thought it was important to help people understand just where she's coming from and the fact that she has become someone who is really quite expert at taking sizable checks from big special interests and certainly those from healthcare.
You write that she was vice president of corporate communications for a big hospital system. What is the skin in the game that the hospital systems have, you know, when we're talking about Medicare for All?
They're very much involved. In fact, there's this organization, I call it an organization, it's really not that. It's more of a front group that was formed last year by health insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and big hospital chains through their trade associations, the American Hospital Association and the Federation of American Hospitals, which is the for-profit hospital organization. And they're pooling their money, all these parts of healthcare, to finance collectively this campaign against Medicare for All. And the hospitals are against it because they've got a good thing going. One of the things I often tell people is that it's not really accurate to think that health insurance companies are really all that much in the game to control healthcare costs. They're not. They can't for one reason or another. Nor do they have a reason to do it or an interest in doing it, because the more healthcare costs go up, the more money they get or able to demand from us in premiums. Hospitals are in on the game in that because health insurance companies cannot really control healthcare costs, they can pretty much have their way with them. So they like the system as it is. They get more money from private insurers than they do from the current Medicare program or for the Medicaid program, and it's because of the weakness and the smallness, if you will, of individual private insurance companies.
Wow, and yet they're pretty big. Nonetheless, a huge part of our economy. You talk about Bustos getting the most contributions from the PACs of all five of the biggest for-profit health insurers, Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Humana, and United Health Group. You say she's being supplied with talking points by the health insurance industry. What are her talking points?
Well, here's how it works. If you are on the take from big industries, you're more willing and your staff is more willing to see a lobbyist from those who are writing those big checks. And some of the talking points here are that this country can't afford Medicare for All, that it would cost too much money, and that so many Americans get their coverage to their workplace that we need to be mindful of that as we're looking at Medicare for All. Those are talking points directly from the insurance industry and this partnership that I mentioned to scare people, to make them think that this is really not something that we should strive for, that there are these reasons why we shouldn't even give it any consideration. It is true. Most Americans who are not enrolled in Medicare or Medicaid or some other public program do get their coverage through private insurers. That's the way it's been in this country for many, many decades. But it doesn't mean it always has to be that way. And the reality also is that many people who are enrolled, in fact, an increasing probably majority of people enrolled in private insurance plans, and in particular those through the workplace, are finding that their coverage is increasingly less valuable, even though they're paying more for it, they and their employers, every single year. So I know that in reality, a lot of people are very dissatisfied with what they're getting for the high premiums they're paying, and they're having to pay more and more out of their own pockets these days for coverage, even if they have insurance. But that's one of those talking points. It is to try to make policymakers and the public believe that for some reason our employer-based system is sacred. We can't touch it.
Yes, and I remember the last time that I got health insurance through an employer, and they instituted a program called Value Plus, but I used to joke that it was more like Value Minus, because I had to pay more to get less.
Right. My last CEO is in the health insurance business at Cigna. Someone asked him what kept him up at night, and he said it is the worry that employers and individuals will wake up and question the value proposition of health insurers, which is a wonky, jargony term that's often used in business, certainly in health insurance. And I think employers and individuals are waking up to question, and rightfully so, the value proposition. What value do they actually bring to this country? And it's questionable. One of the things I used to have to do for a living was to try to make people believe that we had a reason to exist. But increasingly, employers in particular are questioning the reason why we have this middleman in the equation in the first place.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Wendell Potter about his recent post on tarbell.org, Democrats on the Take. Yeah, and let's go to some of the other talking points. She was saying $33 trillion price tag for Medicare for all is just too much. You counter that. How do you counter that?
Well, that actually is only part of the number that from this think tank, actually a conservative think tank that came up with that number. So she's quoting that. But even that think tank said that is at least $2 trillion less over 10 years than what it would be if we continue with the current system. So in other words, even that, yes, that's a big number, but it's over 10 years, first of all. And what she did not tell or say was that would represent less money that the country would spend on health care if we go to Medicare for all than if we don't. The reality is that we currently, this year, we'll spend $3.5 trillion on healthcare as a country. So you multiply that by 10, you've already gotten over $30 trillion, $35 trillion, and that is just based on the assumption that there will be no medical inflation, which of course that's something you have to factor in that. So if we stick with what we've got, we will be spending a heck of a lot more than $33 trillion over the course of the next 10 years. So it's very disingenuous for her to use that number out of context as she did.
Now, the third talking point is, think of all the jobs that are going to be lost for the people who are processing all those claims or, you know, denying all those claims.
Right. And I think that it's a talking point to obscure the reality that the work that they do makes it, in many cases, impossible for the rest of us, the many millions of us, to get the care that we need. A lot of these folks, as you pointed out, they're employed to try to avoid paying claims. Because we have a multi-payer system, which is unique in the world, insurance companies not only have armies of employees who are in the business of determining whether or not someone should get coverage for whatever it is a doctor recommends, but you also, on the provider side, have to have armies of people who do nothing more than deal with insurance company bureaucrats day in and day out. So you've got these tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are employed in our healthcare system who do not do anything to make us better or to help us with our health. In fact, in many cases, it keeps us from getting the care that we need. The other point I would make is that, two points actually, insurance companies have employed literally tens of thousands of nurses who are not providing care, but they are working for these big insurance companies, in many cases standing in the way of the care that we need, and medical directors, doctors as well. So in my view, those folks, they've been trained as caregivers, they should be back at the bedside or providing care in their in offices rather than making it more difficult for us to get care. The other thing is that most of these big insurance companies have diversified over the years. They would not go out of business if we move tomorrow to a Medicare for All plan. They've got other lines of businesses that are really quite profitable and are growing. So it's a fallacy to say that these companies will go out of business, and some people would need to be retrained. Some of them have great training, like doctors and nurses, and could go straight away to work in a better place, in my opinion.
Huh, that's a great point. Wendell Potter, you don't talk about the following thing in your piece, but it's another talking point I've heard coming more from, let's say, the center left. You know, many people in the Democratic Party are saying they're for Medicare for all, although they're beginning to hedge on some of that. And some of them are saying, some of the candidates for 2020 candidates are saying, well, we just want universal coverage and we can do it with the kinds of plans that, let's say, Switzerland has or Germany or Holland, where there are private nonprofit insurance companies that the government pays them and bargains with them. So what is the best way to do Medicare for all?
Right, and I've heard that too, obviously. My response is, why in the world would you not want to do the best job? Why would you want to emulate another country that, yes, they have achieved universal coverage, but they're kind of runners-up with us in terms of how much they spend on health care. We spend almost $10,000 per person per year on health care, which is twice the average of other developed countries, and we have worse outcomes than most of those countries. So we have very little to show for all that we're spending. But Switzerland comes in second in terms of the amount of money that the country spends on health care. Germany's not too far behind. The thing that is distinctive about those countries, that usually those folks you mentioned who advocate for them, is that the insurance companies or sickness funds, as they may be called in those countries, they're heavily regulated, price regulated. They're all nonprofit entities. And we've moved far away from that kind of a structure many decades ago. So insurance companies would be just as resistant to a proposal like that would force them into nonprofit status as Medicare for All. Why do we want to do a half measure? Why do we want to postpone what is inevitable, which is moving to a single-payer healthcare system? And it is the one system of those that are proposed that not only would get us to universal coverage, but would save us the most money. It's a goal. In fact, when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, policymakers knew that we needed to try to do something about a health care cost while also trying to achieve the goal of universal coverage. Policymakers decided during the Obama administration to go first for universal coverage and deal with health care costs later. We see where we wound up. We wound up with a bill that does a great deal of good in terms of bringing a lot of us into coverage, but there's still about 30 million of us who are uninsured. And the other problem is that a fast-growing percentage of us are underinsured because of the way that law was structured and the way that the insurance industry has been going, which is to move every last one of us into a high-deductible plan. And increasingly, those of us who are low and moderate income have trouble meeting our deductible, so we go without care. That's the definition of underinsurance. So why do we want to do second best or third best? Why don't we just do something that really gets us to where we need to be rather than just continuing to tinker with the system that has failed us for many years?
Another thing that I've heard coming out with some of the candidates, and I'm thinking of maybe Jay Inslee, proposals to decrease the Medicare eligibility age to, say, 55 or 50. In other words, an incremental approach. And to the other one is to provide a public option that businesses and people could buy into. In other words, people could buy into Medicare. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, you know, it would be better than not doing anything, I guess. But why, again, do you want to settle for something that is not as good as you can try to get?
Well, the reason is politics. That's what they're
saying. The reason is politics. But like I said, you can expect as much resistance to that as you would to going boldly. In fact, blanking on his name right now, but one of the historians, American historians, was interviewed on TV not too long ago, and he was saying, often if you look at American history or history broadly, you'll see that sometimes it's easier to achieve sweeping change by bold moves than by incremental change. Incremental change can be incredibly tough to pull off. Sometimes bold measures are more successful. But back to that specific proposal, it would add complications to the system. It would not simplify it. And you would keep the insurance industry in place for however long, maybe indefinitely. And it is our multi-payer system that is at the heart of our problem with costs being out of control. And the complexity of our system. Instead of simplifying the system, it just adds greater complexity. And I just see that as a real cop-out to being able to get where we need to be. It does nothing to curb the practices of the insurance industry that are putting more and more of us into the ranks of the underinsured, for example, which is limiting the choices of doctors and hospitals we have in these so-called limited or narrow networks that are in vogue among health insurance companies now. In fact, almost all of them have limitations on the doctors and hospitals you can see. They're forcing you to pay more and more for prescription medications by putting more and more drugs in tiers that cost you more or require that you pay more out of your own pocket. They're making you pay more out of your own pocket broadly through high deductibles. Why do we want to keep a system in place that makes us pay more for care out of our own pockets, even if we have insurance, and to pay more and more every year in premiums? Now, that doesn't make sense to me, and I can't imagine why policymakers would propose that we keep a system like that in place just because it might be easier. It makes no sense to me.
This is affecting cancer drugs too, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, I draw your attention to a piece that is on Tarbell now, written by a leading oncologist from MD Anderson in Houston, about the cost of oncology drugs in particular, cancer drugs. And it's just extraordinary what has happened to the price of pharmaceuticals broadly, but in particular for cancer drugs. And insurance companies are just largely on the sidelines because they are not large enough, not any of them, even the biggest, have enough clout to really do anything to control drug prices. All they are able to do is shift us, require that we take one drug as opposed to another that our doctor might have recommended, or again, shift those medications into tiers that make us pay more. So they're not controlling costs. They're shifting more of the cost to us. And in many cases, as he's pointed out to me, this doctor who wrote that piece, he's seen patients die for economic reasons. They just simply can't figure out the resources to get the medications or the treatments that they need.
Well, Wendell Potter, this has just been really great to have you talking with us here. Thanks so much. And we'll keep on staying tuned to Tarbell, your investigative reporting site on the healthcare industry.
Thank you very much, Francesca. Yes, please check out tarbell.org.
Wendell Potter. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to his article, Democrats on the Take, and to read a transcript of our interview. On March 30th, a federal judge in Alaska ruled that Trump's push to open up the Arctic and part of the Atlantic Oceans to oil and gas drilling is illegal. 10 environmental organizations, including the League of Conservation Voters and some Alaskan indigenous organizations, were the plaintiffs on the case. The lead attorney was Eric Graffy from the environmental law organization Earth Justice. I called Graffy up at his office in Anchorage, Alaska, to find out about the case. I started out by asking him why the plaintiffs took the Trump administration to court.
Well, I'll start with the context, because that'll make it a little easier to understand. When President Obama left office, one of his big conservation achievements was to put in place a permanent drilling ban for 98% of the Arctic Ocean and important canyons, deep water canyons in the Atlantic Ocean, protecting those areas from the dangers of offshore drilling, which are myriad, and also taking us in the right direction to combat climate change, because drilling in places like the Arctic Ocean is looking for fossil fuels that would lock us into fossil fuel use and production for decades to come. And that doesn't make any sense when we have to transition, or start transitioning today from a fossil fuel economy. So President Obama put in place these permanent drilling bans. And when President Trump came into office, he issued an executive order purporting to undo those bans. And we sued President Trump on the basis that he lacks authority to undo that drilling ban. And the court last Friday agreed with us and threw out President Trump's executive order and reinstated the protections that President Obama had put in place.
So this was done by U.S. District Judge Sharon Gleason. Why did she say that an executive order put in by one president could not be undone by another president?
The reason is that there's a law that's part of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act that provides the president with authority to put in place protection. The law, the statute says the president may, from time to time, withdraw areas of the Outer Continental Shelf from disposition. The law is silent as to reversals of those withdrawals. In this context, the court found that law only gives the president power to protect and doesn't give the president the power to undo that. And the reason is that under the Constitution, Congress is given power to manage and dispose of public land. That's under Article 4 of the Constitution. Congress can delegate that power to the president, and it did so in this provision. But when it delegates the power to protect, that doesn't automatically mean it delegates the power to undo those protections. It reserves that power to itself, again, because it's Congress that's managing public lands. And so the court's decision restored the balance of separation of powers and found that President Trump had, in essence, usurped the power of Congress when he unilaterally tried to undo those protections. That's something that only Congress can undo.
So does the fact that this was a decision based on constitutional grounds mean that it will be more difficult to be overturned if it goes to the Supreme Court?
Well, I don't want to speculate as to the eventual appeals path of this decision. An appeal is available to the Trump administration, and that would go first to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But it is true that what this case is affirming is a basic rule of law, separation of powers, structural reality, and that's appealing to all sides of the political spectrum. It's about separation of powers and how our constitutional system works. And this reaffirms that the president's powers in this area are limited and he's not above the law. And it's another example of a court checking this president, President Trump's lawlessness and, you know, just not paying attention to procedures, not paying attention to the limits of his power. We've seen that again and again, and the courts are having to step in and reassert that we're a nation of laws.
Now, I live in a coastal community in New York State. I live on Long Island. And I guess my question is, do the state's attorneys general have any standing to bring suit? Can state's attorneys general sue to protect our oceans and coastlines?
Absolutely. And in fact, some states' attorney generals are, in fact, joining lawsuits aimed at stopping seismic surveying in the Atlantic.
Yes, you mean
related to
those explosions for exploration of oil and gas drilling that kill marine mammals.
Absolutely. And so the Trump administration has authorized that type of very destructive activity to go forward in the Atlantic Ocean. And a number of conservation groups have sued to block that. And I'm aware of at least the South Carolina Attorney General's office weighing in on the side of those challenging those seismic tests. So absolutely, the states have a big role to play, both in the courts and pursuant to other laws like the Coastal Zone Management Act and the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, all of which require consultation with the states, this type of very dangerous seismic testing and oil and gas exploration and drilling in the ocean would affect.
Now, I had heard that Trump is giving out leases for offshore oil drilling. Is that true?
Well, I don't think that's true, because currently there's the regime that still governs offshore leasing is that which was put in place by President Obama in what's called a five-year plan, and that did not schedule any leases in the Atlantic or the Arctic. President Trump is revising that five-year plan. That requires a public process, and they're forging ahead to do that. But unless and until they finish that revision, they wouldn't be able to do any lease sales in the Atlantic Ocean.
If they revise those leases, doesn't that conflict with this ruling by the judge in Alaska?
Right. The ruling reinstates the drilling bans in the Arctic and in the Atlantic canyons, and that means that nobody can sell leases in those areas. So for the Arctic, that would cover 98% of the Arctic, so basic, you know, the vast majority of it. In the Atlantic, it covers these deep water canyons that are biologically very important, but aren't, I think it's about 3.8 million acres. It's not the whole thing. So there are still areas that are potentially threatened with leasing because they're not withdrawn pursuant to this order.
So there's the struggle continues.
Absolutely, the struggle continues, and there's still a big threat from this administration to much of the Atlantic, to the Gulf, and to the Pacific and other parts, other waters in Alaska, which the Trump administration is still eyeing for oil and gas leasing. And in fact, you may recall the initial plan that President Trump released as a revision of the Obama plan, the initial one was scheduling lease sales off every single coast in the United States. So it had was having lease sales everywhere. And they're going to put out a new proposal sometime in the next few weeks or months. But their initial offering of the Trump administration was to open every ocean to destructive oil and gas leasing, threatening the coasts and taking us in exactly the wrong direction that we need to be going if we have a chance of avoiding the worst effects of climate change by not locking ourselves into a fossil fuel future.
And will you and the other organizations be fighting him on those plans?
We will.
Well, Eric Graffy, thank you so much for talking with us here. I really appreciate
it. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on.
Eric Graffy of Earth Justice was the lead attorney on the case challenging the Trump administration's attempt to undo the Arctic Ocean and Atlantic drilling bans. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.